Hi, this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition. We've had a strange summer. This week's show is sponsored by Zendesk and Fabric. Manton, don't you hate it when you've been cruising along and you're doing your work and you're doing the best you can, you're making as much money as you can, and you are paying your taxes, or maybe not paying your taxes, I don't know. And then somebody comes along and says, by the way, you owe us 13 billion euros.
That hasn't happened to me yet. I kind of hope it does happen, because that means that I have like an enormous amount of billions of dollars in my bank account. I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, to be able to get a bill for 13 billion euros and have the means to pay it.
Yeah, or pay all the lawyers to fight it, which is probably what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I don't think anything is going to happen from this for a while. So we're talking about the news that the European Union said, what you're doing in Ireland with this company that doesn't pay hardly any taxes, effectively is 1%, I think, a corporate tax rate to Apple. It's no good.
Yeah. I saw the news. I sort of skimmed it. I didn't read it too in depth, but I did think the numbers, at least the figures, made a pretty compelling case for the EU at least being annoyed by this, if not legally entitled to some compensation. I mean, it's like, you know, I guess the summary, let me see if I can do the like 20-second summary. I think the 20-second summary is special deals between Apple and Ireland mean the rest of the EU feels like Apple is not being taxed enough, and therefore it's a special benefit to Ireland's people.
Right, and it's weird because Ireland's like, hey, we're cool with this. Like,
right, because they're getting they're getting the jobs benefit. And
it's kind of like Apple's saying we didn't get a special deal, but it reminds me of in the States when you have a particular city or state give major tax breaks to a company to move there.
Yes.
Or to build a factory or to have, you know, a bigger presence or whatnot. We see this all the time. Austin does this, Texas, lots of states do this. But I think it's interesting that Tim Cook or someone from Apple said, basically, we find this strange that like Ireland's saying we don't owe anything. So like, who do we pay this tax to? It's not exactly clear, because they're saying like we owe taxes to them because our company's based there, and they're saying you're good.
Right. Well, imagine if, Riverfold Software said, hey, it's cool. Texas told me I don't need to pay any taxes. And so therefore I'm not paying my federal income tax. And then federal government comes along and says, to hell with your deal with taxes. not a perfect metaphor, but it is an example of how complicated, you know, alliances like the EU can be. It probably goes without saying that this would never have become an issue unless Apple became the most like profitable company in the world and happened to be funneling all of its EU business through Ireland.
Right. And I became less sympathetic to Apple when I read more into this, and that, like I said, it really looks like they're effectively paying hardly anything, which, yeah, again, I just, that doesn't seem quite right. And unfortunately, I posted this as a little microblog post this morning. Unfortunately, it kind of reminded me when Donald Trump said, I fight very hard to pay as little tax as possible. And we know a lot of companies are like this. Like, we're trying to pay as little tax as possible. But I don't know. I kind of expect Apple to do not just the letter of the law, but what's right. You know, like they and all other aspects of their business in terms of like their work on helping the environment and renewable energy and rights for employees. And I mean, I don't know. I feel like they usually go above and beyond to do what's right. And in this case, it's like, no, we're paying hardly anything. And we've got this kind of like, not exactly shady, but we've got this kind of interesting structure of companies where we funnel all this money through Ireland in the attempt to not pay as much as we would have to they have presence in every country in the EU, obviously. And presumably that presence could require them to pay taxes specifically. And they do in some cases too, like in terms of VAT and whatnot, the equivalent of sales tax. Like, I'm sure that that's all paid fully. It's just this kind of corporate tax that's kind of special.
Right, which is very huge because the EU is a huge market and Apple is hugely successful. So it sort of strikes me as something where it sort of feels like the scrappy tax attitude. I don't think this is something new that Apple came up with as, you know, a $500 billion company. Like, I think this is probably a sort of strategy they've used.
Yeah, it predates like the iPod. I mean, this, I think it's like 20 years ago.
Yeah, and it's and in that sense, it's like, I guess like anybody's sort of sympathy towards a person or or company trying to pay the least amount of taxes possible, it totally scales with the perceived success of that person or company, right? Like, mm-hmm. at least, you know, I'm sure different people of different political persuasions, I'm sure, see it differently. But for me, it's like, I'm not going to sweat it too much if somebody making $10 an hour is trying to severely minimize their tax bill. Right. And they really, in fact, I support, you know, tax laws that legitimize that and reduce the impact on that level of income. And then on the other end, I also, you know, am of, you know, of the attitude that, yeah, somebody who's making billions of dollars a year, it feels a little petty when they're like trying to cut corners and like mm-hmm. shave $500 off their bill here and there. On the other hand, when you, like, for instance, cite that quote about trying very hard to pay as little in taxes as possible, I don't personally know a single person who doesn't also sort of try to do that, right?
Well, sort of, but only people who are rich or big companies, rich companies, have the means to actually follow through on that statement. You know, like, I could say I try to pay as little as in taxes as allowed by the law, but without an army of accountants,
yeah,
I can't do that, right? I pay just some average amount. I probably maybe even overpay in some cases. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because it requires a lot of effort to pay the least possible. And I mean, just look at the kind of structure that Apple is set up to kind of do that. And I'm not saying that, again, they're not doing anything that's illegal or anything, but it requires a lot of work. I don't think most people that say, I don't want to pay a lot of taxes, can actually pay the least possible.
No, and I don't think anybody does pay the least possible. But just like the point being, like, there's a strong tradition of using every legal opportunity afforded to you. For example, and I've struggled with this sometimes because it's like, okay, oh, why am I working so hard to like find another way to cut my taxes down? Well, partly I guess it's because I want the money. I think I can do better things with the money sometimes than, you know, whatever government entity is getting it. Also, I guess it's more than that. I often feel like I need the money, you know, or I have felt like it various times in my life. But it sort of, I think, does become a kind of habit where it's like, okay, well, you know, for example, Manton, like when I buy anything for my business, of course, I deduct that. And there's some people out there who would be like, geez, you know, it's just shaving like a few hundred dollars off your tax bill. Like, what's the deal? Like, just support your government. And, you know, there's sort of like a disconnect between like, I want the government to have, you know, money to provide all these services that I appreciate. And I do, I mean, I'm sort of saying all this just to sort of get my head around, like, what does it really mean for Apple to try as hard as they do not to pay any more taxes than necessary? And I obviously, it's a hugely different thing. And like you said, the articles at least painted as if they're paying effectively nothing. And there was one example where it was like, wasn't it like 1 year, maybe 2014, that said it was something like 0.005%.
It was like, yeah, it was like less than 1%. And so one of the reasons this is so interesting too is, I mean, the world has changed a little bit, obviously, and we sell software over the internet. And this is something that independent software developers run into. And you see this on a state-by-state basis in the U.S. where, you know, you have sales tax in Texas, and it's not clear sometimes what to do from someone buying from California, you know, for my, I mean, I don't have a presence in California. So like when I first looked at this years ago for my own business, what I came up with is I need to pay sales tax for people that are in Texas buying my software because I have a presence here. And so I do, I've always done that. And it's a total pain. Every quarter I calculate how much sales tax I've collected and I pay the state. It's hardly anything because it's only people that have bought from Texas, right? Not anywhere else in the world. And it seems weird, but I don't know. I tried to kind of follow the rules as best I can. And you have the same thing in Europe where these other countries are like, wait a minute, what's going on here? You know, Apple has a presence everywhere. Why aren't we getting some share of that? And even just, I haven't looked at this in detail. Actually, I've looked at this in detail just in the last 12 hours as I was reading through this stuff about the new rules that affect all software developers in theory, where if you sell to someone in Europe, you're supposed to collect tax and you're supposed to distribute that. You know, there's a way to register once and have it distributed to all the appropriate European countries. I think most people probably don't do that. I currently don't do that, but it seems like, I mean, technically, you know, you're supposed to. If you assume that Europe has some weird jurisdiction where they can like enforce what a Texas software company does,
coming after you, Riverfold.
Yeah, and that, well, they don't care. And that's another thing that I wanted to bring up is, while they technically don't care, those laws are designed to stop Amazon and bigger companies from having a presence in the European country that has the lowest tax. And basically not, you know, the other countries around are not getting any share of that. But even though it's designed for those big companies, it affects everybody because usually, sometimes at least, there's not a minimum. Like it's, if you only make $100 a year, you're still supposed to pay. And I kind of like it when there's some kind of threshold. So in Texas, for example, there's a tax for just being a business, right? Registering with a state and being a LLC. I think it's something like you don't have to pay if you make less than like $1 million or $2 million or something. So it's really only for larger companies, small little one, two people companies. They say, don't worry about it. You still have to file like, I don't owe anything, like $0. But it's a little less paperwork and a little less headache for smaller companies, which is nice.
Yeah, it really is a shame when these things that seem so specifically designed to go after money from big companies not only sort of don't succeed in getting the money from smaller companies, but they also don't completely exculpate the smaller companies. So then the smaller companies are left to either like painstakingly go through the maybe technically legal process of handling it, or like live in fear of having done something wrong.
Right.
You know, this is actually a benefit and advantage of, and an advantage I think a lot of people cite for things like the app stores, because, you know, some folks who are selling software, you know, only on iOS have no idea what we're talking about, worrying about collecting VAT from people.
Yeah.
Right. Because, this is not something that, you know, this is something that, as far as I know, this is something that the App Store takes care of for you.
For the most part, there's that weird exception with Japanese paperwork you have to deal with, which I've never understood, because if Apple is the one selling your software, that should be completely hidden from you. But in that case, at least, it's not completely hidden from you,
and
which
that's
I find strange.
I forget the details of that. It's something subtle where that's, I think, not a VAT. That's they charge a VAT in Japan and then some other tax on top of that. And it's, I think, the other tax that that you get out of by filing that paperwork. But I don't
right. know, but I again, like that's not to get too derailed here, but Apple should be the one filing that paperwork for you if they're the ones that are actually selling the software. Like Apple, in that case, I think is trying to have it both ways. You know, they're helping you in that they are selling the software directly, have the relationship with the customer, they're dealing with tax and all the states and countries that they have to deal with. But then on that case, like, oh, wait, no, you're the one selling the software. You have to file the paperwork. So that's a little strange.
I would like to just defend Apple a little bit on that front, because they I think what's going on there is that Japan won't accept Apple being the one to deal with that. It's like Japan wants a relationship with every single individual seller. To Apple's credit, they do an awful lot of work to streamline that on behalf of developers. Like, you know, it's hard enough filling out the forms, but Apple gives you pretty good guidance. And then Apple will tell you, like, if you've done something wrong on a form sometimes. Actually reminds me, I need to get back on them because I had to refile again last year, I think. And I don't think I ever heard anything. And I haven't checked recently whether I'm getting taxed on that again. But I think, to Apple's defense, that is a situation where it's like the thing that gets you out of paying that tax is it's like a it's way beyond Apple in Japan. It's like a U.S.-Japanese treaty that you have to like fulfill these specific form-based things to take advantage of. And I think I'm forgetting now. I think the deal is that Apple is not really a reseller, something like that. I don't know. It's complicated, but
yeah.
But yeah, I think they do handle a lot of tax stuff. But don't listen to us. We're obviously not experts about this because we can't even put together two of the basic concepts of what's being taxed here or not. Just making that disclaimer because for all I know, I'm totally wrong, and Apple is not handling anything regarding VAT. I have seen some weird things actually over the years that made me wonder, what the heck am I responsible for? And that just goes to support my original statement there that it's really unfair. It's, you know, getting back to the core of this show being about indie software development, it's really an unfair burden how much some entities expect us as individuals or small companies to figure out and wrap our heads around. And I've sort of always been of the mind that, hey, whatever entity wants to take this money from me needs to make it really easy to take the money from me. By making it really difficult to take the money from me, they're increasing the chance that I'm just not going to figure it out, and therefore, like, inadvertently or by throwing my arms up, not going to pay them. Or, or I'll have to, like, you know, spend an inordinate amount of money. You know, you never want to be spending more money to pay a tax bill than the tax itself. That's the absurdity of it.
Yeah. I always run into that with my sales tax because I'm always late. And so they tack on $50. And so it's not a lot more, but I always pay $50 more. It's really frustrating. I don't really know if there is an easy way to make this easier for companies. I mean, I'm sure there is, but like, I'm not, without having someone in between you and the customer, like a reseller, like the App Store, or like, you know, there's several popular, you know, software, you know, payment gateways that sell Mac software and, you know, web software and that kind of thing. And they handle all this for you too. But without something kind of in the middle, I don't know how simple you can get this. You just have to, yeah, you just have to bite the bullet, write a 13 billion euro check.
Well, I'm sure I'm minimizing the complexity here, but just for example, if I were the EU and I legitimately wanted to get every penny, you know, euro penny, whatever they call them, what are they called? I don't know. what is a euro penny? Is it called a penny? A cent? I don't know. Do they have pennies?
I forget. I was only there a year ago.
I've only been recently to... Well, I should have encountered them in Amsterdam. So anyway, somebody will have to. No, don't.
I think they might be called Eurocents.
Audience, please don't tweet us, don't email us about this. We will Google it soon. But suffice to say, we don't have it at the tips of our tongues. If
it's got to be a cent, it's got to be a cent.
Yeah, it's probably like it's a milli euro or something. It's a decimal. It's a what. Well, I don't even.
Whatever. Continue.
Oh yeah, well, cent would be right, wouldn't it? It's showing my metric ignorance. Hey, what else can I show my ignorance about right here? But no. So here, you said Manton. I don't know what they can do to make it easier. Well, here's one like naive suggestion. If I were the EU and I wanted people to have a really easy time of paying me, I would have like a web API service and here my ignorance might reveal that this exists and I just don't know about it, but I don't think this exists. So I thought about the similar idea for New York State when I was living there, because they have a similarly convoluted address-based tax system. They should have a publicly accessible system where you feed in an address and a zip code, postal code, whatever, and an amount of sale, and it tells you how much VAT you owe on that, right?
Right. And there are companies that do that, right? You have to pay them, like, subscriptions. But, like, there's companies that's their whole job, practically, is to manage. I mean, usually payment gateways and stuff have those kind of APIs. Because there's literally thousands of these different tax, you know, rates across. Like, if you just look in the U.S., technically, like, every county, in some cases, can have its own thing. And for Texas, I just use the one for the county I'm in. Mm-hmm. Because it's effectively the maximum sales tax for the state, and it's just simpler that way. And I actually think that is correct in some ways. But I know, I know some people that look at the zip code from where you're. I mean, that's how I do it. I look at the zip code, but I only use the zip code to figure out what state you're in, not like actually what county you're in.
Well, in New York, it's terrible because the tax rate can vary by like. Within, I don't know if it's down to like within towns, but it's kind of close to that. It's like,
right.
And so you actually have to have the street address. You can't like meaningfully figure this out without like this convoluted stretch of a thing.
So yeah, I think it's the thing that I guess it's different for every state, but for me, when I pay my sales tax, they don't ask me to break it down by city. So I think that's why I said, I think I'm doing it correctly. Like if I opened up a little shop in a town 100 miles away, I would obviously charge the state and local sales tax that was correct for my little shop. But if I'm just dealing with Texas as a whole, I don't think there's a way to file it and say, you know, here are the individual cities that sales came from.
Well, as long as you're not charging the customers the tax. I think that's true. I think technically you should be charging the customers the tax. However, the problem with your approach, if you're charging the highest tax rate to all the customers, then you're overtaxing some customers, and that's a problem.
So I'm pretty sure I am doing that.
Mm-hmm. So, well, let me just sneak in this quick suggestion, Manton, before the feds come after you. Not the feds. I'm joking. But I think a minor tweak to your approach would be to charge all your customers the lowest tax rate in the state, and then you pay the state the highest tax rate for all of them. Because, you know, and this is all just like fiddly details, but I think it's a worse offense, technically speaking, to overtax somebody than to. I don't think the state cares if you cough up for the tax. That's why these stores and stuff will have like tax-free weekend, you know, when they say, oh, the furniture's on sale and you don't pay any tax. Well, the store is still paying the tax. So I think the thing to do for anybody who wants to minimize the complexity of this, and I know somebody else in New York State who does a similar thing to this, and this is it. You collect, you either don't collect at all and you just cough it up for the whole tax burden yourself, and that's one approach, or you collect the lowest that anybody could possibly be expected to pay and make up the difference, which will just be pennies, you know.
But yeah, exactly. Pennies add up. But yeah, for me, it would be hardly any money. I guess the way I look at it, I mean, you can read this lots of different ways too. That's why, I mean, I'm sure an accountant wouldn't read it in multiple ways. He'd say, this is exactly, or a tax attorney, this is exactly how it should work. But like, I don't view it that differently than if someone like came to my city and bought something from me, in which case, you know, someone that was just, again, in the neighboring town, they drove to Austin and they bought something.
Yeah.
I would charge them sales tax in my city. And so it's, I think I can maybe, I don't know legally, but it seems like I can justify, again, because the state doesn't ask you to break it down. And if they don't ask you to break it down like that, it seems ridiculous to want to do that. But again, it just gets back to your point. This is extremely complicated. Most people don't do it correctly. I'm kind of trying, but there's certainly things that I'm not doing correctly. And
yeah,
European tax is one of those that I'm not doing correctly.
Well, it definitely gets complicated. All right, folks, we're very excited to announce that we have a new sponsor this week, and it's Zendesk. In most apps, mobile customer service is just a contact us link that launches an email. This makes it difficult for users to get customer service when they need help and leads to wasted time and frustrated users. With the Zendesk Embeddables mobile SDK, you can bring native in-app support to your app quickly and easily. Your users can view self-service content and submit tickets right from within your app. Best of all, it's quick to implement and is included with Zendesk at no extra charge. Learn more at zendesk.com/coreint.
Yeah, so I was glad when Zendesk approached us about sponsoring the show because it turns out I've been using Zendesk. That's how I do all my customer support for at least a couple of years now. And I'm really happy with it. It's a web interface for doing support that at first I wasn't exactly sure about, like 2 years ago, whenever I started, because it's a little different than email, but it's designed to make it quicker than email, right? So you can more quickly like have a workflow that gets you through, especially if you have a queue of messages to reply to, be able to kind of quickly go and reply and then also say, okay, this is pending or I need an answer from someone or this is open or closed or whatever. So really good system. It's been around for a while and I really like it. But on this show, they want us to talk about the SDK you can use in your iOS app or on the web and Android for that matter to make it easier for customers to interact with Zendesk if you are using them. So I actually tried this out. I put the SDK in the beta version of one of my iPhone apps, basically had like a kind of like a get help or contact button, and it uses the SDK. It's like one line of code, a couple lines of code, to bring up a UI that allows the customer to say, you know, this is my problem. They can attach an image. It's like all the UI is just built for you with the SDK. And then it directly submits to Zendesk as a support ticket. And you can also have, you know, you can list support tickets, you can view your knowledge base, that kind of stuff. But I just added the part that allows them to submit. So instead of having to go to their email client or use like a little built-in mail controller, it brings up something that's custom. User can type in their problem directly in your app and it goes to your support system. So really easy to integrate. And you can also do things like you can have them submit anonymously, or if you already know who the customer is. So in this case, in this particular iPhone app, I already know who the user is because they're logged into the service. So when I set up the Zendesk controller, I can just say this person's name and email is this. And then they don't have to worry about typing that in or anything as a customer. They just type in their problem. And when it submits a ticket to my system, it automatically, you know, has their email so they can get replies if they want to, has their name so I know who they are and can say, hi, Bob, or, you know, whatever. Looks like a good SDK. I have it in the beta version of my app. And if anyone is using Zendesk or needs to use Zendesk, something to handle support, email, and questions in a more organized fashion, check out Zendesk and check out the mobile SDK. And you can learn more at zendesk.com/coreint. So, Daniel, when Apple isn't busy cutting 13 billion euro checks, they are busy on AI, apparently, and deep learning and machine learning.
Yeah.
there's an article that just came out, I guess it wasn't too long ago, and I was about to say it was Wired, but it wasn't Wired. It was backchannel.com, which is a Medium site, and I don't even know who I haven't read the site before, so I don't know who runs it exactly. But the article is written by Stephen Levy. Mm-hmm. Is it Levy or Levy?
I never can tell. And it was funny. I listened to the talk show, and they had the same question.
Right. I was hoping you would know.
You know, and I'm looking at this just to validate your hunch about it being part of Wired. Sidebar on the back channel Medium says part of the Wired Media Group. So
interesting.
I guess it's kind of like Wired's Medium blog. I don't know.
So they gave Stephen access to a bunch of Apple, you know, vice presidents, engineers, to talk about, to kind of defend Apple in a way and say, hey, you've heard that we're falling behind Google and Facebook and Amazon, everybody else. No, it's not true. We're at the forefront. You know, we're doing all this machine learning stuff and it's on your device and it's powering a bunch of stuff, including mm-hmm. Siri improvements that you are already getting used to.
I think this is very interesting because we've been hearing now for about 3 years this sounds about right to me, that like AI and machine learning has been like, I know it's been going on much, much longer than that, but it seems like it's been about 3 years that people have been like overtly criticizing Apple for not being like on the bandwagon, for allegedly not being on the bandwagon. Also, over those past few years, most people I know have been speculating, of course Apple's working on this. Like, the reason you don't know anything about it is because it's Apple. And Willy Wonka doesn't share, you know, like the fizzy lifting drink recipe. It's like part of Apple's culture to not share this stuff. And that's kind of what makes this article interesting, is they're sort of coming out and saying, hey, no, we're relevant. And if you take it at face value, I think it's actually pretty compelling, because to just like summarize it in general, I think it's fair to say that Apple's approach is, we are not we are not like part of AI academia, but we have a lot of smart people who are like learning about the AI academia and putting it to good work. And if you think back historically, Apple has never been at the forefront of academia, right? They go to places like Xerox PARC and see cool things, and then they take them and they turn them into consumer products. And like, could you imagine, you know, somebody saying, well, Apple's really going to miss the boat on, you know, pointer devices, because they haven't done any research into, you know, graphical user interfaces and pointer devices. Well, they didn't need to do the research. They needed to have some smart people who saw that, you know, cutting edge technology existed, and then go latch onto that and say, we'll take that, please. And we'll turn that into a product.
Yeah, it's interesting in terms of like the article itself. It actually, there's a little bit of conflict, but on one part, it makes that case that Apple says, you know, we don't publish papers and like all that kind of stuff. We just want to get smart people that can make our products better. But then later down, you're reading, and there's a part where they say, actually, in this one particular area, we think Apple's contribution is so valuable and so significant to the world that we are authorizing our scientists to publish a paper about it. And when I read that, it was a little strange, because, again, it was kind of like, on one hand, they're saying, we don't publish papers, we just want to make great products. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they're saying, well, in this one area, we are going to. And it was almost an admission that, like, maybe they don't have a lot of areas where they feel like they've really contributed anything. And maybe that's being a little too critical, but it's still, they're saying multiple things right. Kind of at the same time. I like this, and I'm still kind of skeptical, though, that they are placing such a big bet on doing the opposite of what Google and everybody else is doing, in terms of everybody else is doing all this deep learning, fancy stuff in the cloud with thousands of servers, and Apple is doing it on your device. And mm-hmm. maybe that's great, but what if it doesn't pan out? What if they do fall behind? Then what are they going to do? Like, are they going to just say, okay, we were wrong about that? Or are they just going to be okay with being a couple steps behind, just because the scope of what they're trying to do is limited to the phone in a lot of ways?
Yeah, I guess that, you know, the considering the worst case scenario, as you've sort of put it out there, like, what if it just point blank just doesn't work? And I think what you mean by that is, if it doesn't work to such an extent that Apple's AI or machine learning becomes irrelevant to the point of uselessness when contrasted with Google and other companies.
I wouldn't say uselessness, but yeah, just like not as good.
Right. Well, like, you know, I mean, for it to be a failure, it has to sort of be perceived as, because to be honest, it can be like 90% as good. And if that doesn't cause customers to abandon Apple's platforms, then that's quote unquote okay, right? And we might suffer a little bit for it from the lack of functionality. But I think by definition, if we're not abandoning the platform, then it's not really affecting us too much. So I would think back to other technological breakthroughs that you literally could not proceed if you didn't get on board. Like, for example, makers of laptops who were maybe defiant about the idea of Wi-Fi, right? Like, at some point, it became really, really obvious that if you couldn't make Wi-Fi available for your laptop, you're out of this game. And, you know, that's a situation where 20 years ago, every laptop in the world didn't have Wi-Fi. And they were perfectly fine. They were great portable computers. And you could have looked at it and said, no. You don't need that. That's not the core of what it means to be a laptop computer. And I think kind of the way to compare that to what Apple's AI machine learning challenge is this kind of intuitive seeming, you know, machine assisted, you know, behavior, is it a core of what it means to have a computer or a phone going forward? Like, is it in 10 years from now, is, you know, hey, Siri, show me a picture of that time I was having an ice cream cone in July at Coney Island, and knowing with 110% certainty that it's going to pop right up, is that a core feature of computing? And I would be inclined to say that yes, it is, because I do think that, you know, over the course of 10 years, if Google, for example, is doing that for 9 years and we're still waiting for Apple to be able to do it reliably, I think that's going to be a big problem. So I think there's something to be said for this being taken seriously and being a real problem. But I guess I also think then that if Apple's approach fails, we're going to know about it within the next few years. And I think that would be an opportunity for Apple to then say, okay, this isn't working. We need to abandon this and go take another tack at this.
Yeah, I do think this is a legitimately core part of the user experience for computers going forward, especially as we have more and more data, like being able to do a query, like you just said, super useful. And I think Apple realizes that, and that's why, you know, Siri's coming to the Mac. That's why they're investing so much in improving it, and it has improved. But there's also something about the scope of this problem that I almost wonder if Apple is limiting themselves. Like, they're not, like, their approach is, I mean, it's really difficult. I don't want to like downplay what they're doing, because they've got super smart people on this and they made a huge improvements and they're doing really hard work, but their scope is smaller. Like, the things they're trying to do are still kind of smaller. And when I look at the Siri SDK is a perfect example of that, I think. Like, it knows how to do a few things. You can plug your app into a few things, whatever it is, 7 or 8 things. And then, you know, in the article, they even point out, like, Apple, basically, they say, well, you look at Amazon's Echo, their Alexa Skills API, it has thousands of things, but, like, you can't use them. They're, you know, you have to speak in a certain way. You can't phrase it in different ways. It's harder to use or whatever. And so our approach is a few things really well and powerful, and that's fine now, but like a few things really great is not good enough if we are interacting with our computers and our phones with voice more significantly all the time. I mean, a few things is not enough. And so then the burden is on Apple to expand that to hundreds of things, thousands of things. Whereas the approach I think that Google and Amazon are taking is, we're going to let other people expand it, which I think there's something really kind of, I don't know, just powerful and interesting about opening it up and saying, you know, anyone can add to this platform. And yeah, it's clunky at the beginning.
Yeah, I don't know. I listened very recently to the talk show episode with Guy English and John Gruber, and they talked a little bit about this. And I thought one of the good points was how we can still anticipate a lot of processor improvements on mobile, and in particular, because I think that's where a lot of this machine learning, this distributed machine learning, is going to happen. That's where all the devices are, and that's where, like, a lot for me in particular, like, and I think I am representative of many people. Like, even if Siri comes to the Mac, which it is, most of my Siri interaction, for example, is with my phone, and most of my kind of like, I guess, like arbitrary information stuff is with my phone, like assistance type behavior is with my phone. And I do like real work, quote unquote, on my Mac. And my phone is like my little buddy that comes along with me and helps me get through the world. And I'm really naive about the whole field of AI and machine learning. But the argument that my device with complete access to my information and with a pretty substantial CPU and with only the problem of like kind of working with my own data can provide a lot for me. And granted, that's, you know, I guess like, you know, what do you really gain by being Google and having everybody's information in the server? Well, one of the major things is you can correlate between different people's data, and that's where it starts to get creepy, I guess.
Yeah, but there's more than that, though. I think you can, like, getting to this open issue, if it's all on your device, you can't grow it. Only Apple can, right? And that's the thing that bothers me the most about when I think about the limited scope of this. I'm not talking about matching pictures of like what's a mountain and what's a flower or whatever, although I do think Google is going to be ahead on that. Maybe Apple's is fine, but I do think Google, I mean, Google Photos is incredible, how well it works. But I'm thinking more about like how open this could be as a platform. Like, again, Siri knows how to do some things, some great things. And like on the talk show you mentioned, John pointed out, you know, some things like the Siri can do better than Alexa in terms of the weather and stuff. But something like Amazon's Echo can do like crazy thousands of things. You know, like I'm sure there's like allergy reports and like all sorts of specific skills you can add. It doesn't know them out of the box. You have to say, you know, add this. But just the idea that you could have a platform that is more open and that it can expand and grow and learn things, that's appealing to me. Whereas if it's only on Apple to add everything, like when you start using Siri all the time, you said there's a lot that Siri can do now, and that's true. But like, if you're using Siri all the time, at some point, you're going to want to do things that Siri can't do. And you have to wait a year for Apple to add that feature.
But that's an Apple philosophy thing, not a device versus cloud thing, right? Like Apple's decision to keep things on the device is also a philosophy thing, but there's no, you know, that you're complaining about a limitation of the SDK and access that developers get to that sort of body of machine learning knowledge.
I think it's both. I think it's related to the cloud because there are some types of things that require the cloud, you know, to act on you. I mean, a lot of what you ask Siri to do needs the cloud, even if it's something right, that Apple built. But there's also a philosophical thing in that, like, if we talk about Siri being a new type of UI for computers, sorry, not just Siri, but any voice-activated thing, which I think it is. Okay, well, where are the apps? Like, if you think about the graphical user interface as a new way to interact with computers,
Yeah. It
would be crazy to say Apple's the only one that can build graphical user interface apps. Like, that would be nuts, right? But that's what they're doing effectively with this.
But I don't feel like it's a that particular shortcoming of Siri doesn't reflect a sort of handicap that Apple couldn't break free from if it became obvious that they needed to do. And so it's not like, it's not the same as saying like, oh, Apple took the wrong course choosing to do like differential privacy and storing everything on the phone because, you know, it turns out you can't do XYZ amazing thing that everybody expects a computer to do. And that's I think the fear is that whether the lack of creepiness of Apple will lead to a sort of dead end of functionality where people expect it to do things that only people with creepy access can do.
That's fair. Like, you know, I just think it's I worry that this kind of stubborn, we're drawing a line in the sand kind of thing will blind them to what they should be doing a couple years from now. But you're totally right. I mean, there's nothing to stop them from expanding what they're doing over the years, and I hope they do. But it's also possible that they'll be so entrenched on this idea that they won't see what they should be doing.
It's always possible with Apple, and they're definitely not not fail-proof when it comes to these kinds of things. They've been getting pretty lucky over the last several years. And it brings me back to something you said early in this discussion, which was you sort of highlighted the fact that Apple's doing the opposite of everybody else. And it really rung a bell in my head when you said that, because doing the opposite of what everybody else does is exactly why Apple is as successful as they are today. So it can go both ways, obviously. And yeah, sometimes you really don't want them to do the opposite of everybody else. But it's one of those things where it's like, geez, who are we to criticize at this point? let's see how they do. And I also remain fairly optimistic, because to be honest, I'm in the camp of people who I'm frustrated almost every day by something Siri does, but I am also increasingly impressed by what it does. And so it doesn't feel like an empty claim to me when Apple says that they have been putting significant investment into the technology. You know, there was that aspect of the article, I think, that said like such and such a day they flipped some switch and it changed the way Siri worked. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember noticing that switch. I wasn't like, whoa, what happened today? Like, Siri is suddenly smart. But over some period of time, I did start noticing Siri was getting things that, the way like Siri rewrites its like interpretation of what you said. Sometimes that's really impressive. And I'm like, wow, you really picked up on something there. And I have to imagine that is that kind of AI stuff playing out. And I always try to keep in mind with Apple, I really think this is still true, that we are rarely seeing the cutting edge of what Apple can do when we see the products. Maybe with the hardware, I don't know. Maybe I'm not as familiar with hardware realities of hardware, so I kind of feel like it's more likely that with the hardware they are often kind of pushing, you know, whatever is at least affordable and can be done. But I feel like a lot of times with software, they're holding out on you know, achieving something, and then we get it all in one swoop. But that sort of contradicts also what they're saying with Siri, that they're gradually improving it. But I guess I continue to have a lot of faith in Apple, that I do think their attitude of getting smart people, putting them on a task and saying, hey, how much can you learn about this? You know, sometimes like the best result can come from somebody who's not encumbered by like all of the inside knowledge about how a field has been, you know, developed over the years. I think you can get somebody, you could get somebody and put them into like an AI field and say, hey, you don't know anything about this, but learn as much as you can in the next 6 months. And I think there's a good chance they could come out of that with more practical ability to put that into consumer hands than somebody who's just been like, you know, heads down studying that subject forever. So that is sort of as a rule that gives me optimism about the way Apple, I think Apple has this kind of skill to come in and say, we'll take that technology and we'll put a consumer spin on it. And that is just kind of their magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I certainly agree. I have no complaints at all with the improvements to Siri. I mean, and I think the article makes a really good case for, you know, we've been slowly over the years, we've been acquiring companies, we've been hiring scientists and people, we've been rolling out, like on that day when we flipped a switch and Siri got better. No, I have no complaints at all. I mean, that sounds amazing. It's more on the scope of like, are they tying their hands a little bit with some of the choices they make about, I mean, privacy is good. That goes creepy sometimes. It has random, like, 2-second recordings in the cloud of, like, my family and I, like, screaming at Alexa to turn the volume down or something. But, this is a big deal. Like, voice stuff, I think, is a huge kind of, you know, frontier for user interfaces. And so I want it. There's a lot of things I want to do personally that I can't do on Apple platforms right now. And so I'd like Apple to think really big about that. And the different for different sake, I mean, that has served Apple fairly well, but usually they're better, not just different than the competition. In this case, better in some ways, not as good in other ways. So we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. And also, we've been focusing a lot on Siri in particular, but of course, machine learning has a lot of other, you know, you mentioned the photo identification and stuff, but it's also possible that Apple will come up with consumer-facing, you know, applications of this that none of the others thought about. Because, you know, they may just not be thinking about it the same way. And so I'm excited to see what comes out of this. You know, it may be nothing, but you follow Apple long enough and you know that there's eventually going to be another, oh my God, I can't believe they did that moment. And that's kind of what we live for, right? As Apple fans.
Yep.
And hopefully over the years, they will loosen up, you know, their restrictions on the API. I've really gotten kind of chilled out about it, I guess, in recent years, because maybe I'm sort of just resigned to it. But, you know, they do actually, if you wait long enough, wait 10 years, they open up. You know, we couldn't even make apps the first year of the iPhone. And then over years, things have gotten more and more, you know, extensible, and, you know, you get access to more SDKs. And I think there's cause for optimism these days. When you see something minimal that Apple presents, there's cause for optimism that if that has any uptake, you will see, you know, expansion of those concepts in that facility.
I hope so. All right, we're happy to have Fabric from Twitter sponsoring the show again this week. Fabric is a suite of tools for developers that I've been using for years now, going back to the original Crashlytics for doing crash reporting, and also increasingly to the Analytics and their Answers product, where you can kind of see a snapshot of how your app is doing, how many active users, crash-free users, what versions of your app people are on. Just a really beautifully designed dashboard, an iPhone app, being able to see how your app is doing so you know, are people, is your app working? Are you having crashes? Are people upgrading? What kind of features in your app are people using? It's just a really great suite, and it's totally free. Fabric from Twitter.
Yeah, you know, Manton, it's been a few weeks since we had a Fabric spot on the show. And what the great thing about Fabric is they're always working on improving their stuff. And you can catch up pretty quickly if you want to see what's new by going to fabric.io/blog. And I love how forthcoming they are about all the stuff they're doing. They have a blog post usually every month, maybe every month. And it's like, you know, what they've been doing for the past month. And then they even have like an internal change log, and they list for each of their products, like the key things that have changed for the product. You got Crashlytics, Answers, Digits, Twitter Kit, MoPub, and they go into detail about the stuff they've been working on. This is not a service where it's like, oh, Twitter decided to make a developer service and just put it out there and you know, let it sit there and we'll see how it goes. This is like, it's hard for me to think of a developer product that is more actively developed than the Fabric SDK. And it's a great idea to go check this blog out every once in a while just to see what they've been up to. They got stuff with their Answers solution where they have a new feature to help you understand how engaged your users are. And I love this phrase, how many are at risk of abandoning your app? That's like, that'll strike a chill into any indie developer. So this is, as Manton said, completely free service. It's backed by Twitter. It's, you know, therefore it has like really reliable. It can handle, obviously, I don't know how many millions or maybe it's billions of requests it gets. It's a great service that we've been talking about for years now on this show. And it's great to be able to talk about them again. And as always, you can learn more at fabric.io. Thanks so much to Fabric for sponsoring the show. All right, Manton, I think for most of us in the U.S. at least, summer, at least as it relates to summer vacation and kids, is officially coming to a close. It's something funny in the U.S. at least. It's crept forward for a lot of people. Like, I know some people, their kids went back to school as long ago as 3 weeks ago, like early August. Here in New England, in the Boston area, I think we're still sort of on a traditional, like, I feel like an oddity here in that my kids are actually going back to school same way I did, dang it, the day after Labor Day.
As it should be.
As it should be, right? Like, every day of my, every school year of my childhood, as was the case, I think, for most people in public schools around the country, you'd go back to school the day after Labor Day. And somehow here in Boston, at least in Arlington, they still do it that way. So next week, my kids will head back to school. And, you know, we've talked a bit about this over the summer, like how the summer can kind of play tricks on your ability to get much done. And, you know, especially those of us with a flexible schedule, it means maybe you take several consecutive vacations. maybe you have more of a lure to hang out with the kids, take them out on special outings. Maybe you're just taking longer, you know, long weekends more often. Or maybe it's just the attraction of the summer months makes you want to get out on your own sometimes and take a hike or go for a run or whatever. The boring, cool fall. Well, it's not going to be cool for you. You're in Austin, but
it's hot already.
The boring, cool fall is coming, and therefore we will have hopefully back to a more productive work schedule.
Yeah, now fall is actually pretty nice here usually, but not quite yet. It's still August. Our summer lasts quite long, but yeah, my kids are back in school. They started last week. So we're just kind of used to like going back to school in August now. Luckily, it's toward the end of August. It's not at the beginning. But it was interesting because we've had a strange summer with lots of people traveling, but not all at the same time, and lots of different events going on with the kids. And so they went back to school, and that first day where I was at home by myself working all day, it was great, actually, because I had a lot of things I needed to get done. And I literally worked 8 hours. I worked, like, I started working. I worked a bunch. And, you know, I, like, get up. Like, I don't sit at my desk for 4 hours straight. But, like, I get up a little bit and let the dogs out or do whatever I need to do, have lunch. But, like, I was basically at home 8 hours by myself and got a bunch done.
And wait, who let the dogs out? Who? Right. Yeah, it's funny that we have to sort of celebrate having an honest work day. Like, yay us. We actually did what, like, most people do every day.
I know. But it's just been unusual. I just haven't had, you know, and it's been great. Like, I love spending time with my family and not being tied to my desk 8 hours a day. But sometimes you need that, right? Sometimes you need, like, uninterrupted time. And this isn't an exact comparison to people who work at a regular job because, I mean, you work in an office in cubicle land or something, good luck having 8 hours uninterrupted.
Right.
I mean, that's not going to happen either, right? So having that much time was great. And I think the day after that, I went down and worked downtown at the co-working place for 4 or 5 hours. Again, long uninterrupted time. Got my free iced coffees, got my headphones on. So I feel like I'm getting back into productivity. I've gotten a lot done this summer, but I mean, I have so much to get done, and I feel like I'm really checking things off the OmniFocus list now.
Oh, really? Yeah? You got that Kickstarter in the can?
Except that.
Oh, I'm just going to... You know, I ran out of things to tease you about when you started using Twitter actively, and you know, with enthusiasm. So
I don't know about that. If by enthusiasm you mean I wrote software that crossposts to Twitter from my blog to Twitter, then yeah. The Kickstarter and all my independent projects actually had a little bit of setback for the last month or two because I've really gotten away from my goal for this last year, which was work, you know, 50% of the time on my own projects, 50% of the time on other people. And I mean, lately it's, you know, I'm in 90%+ like on consulting work. And that that's been a huge focus over the last few weeks. I have a lot of projects to work on, a lot of things to get done, and I'm making progress and I'm happy with that. But I mean, the reality is like, there's only so much I can get done. If I'm putting that many hours into other people's apps.
You really have to find space for, in my experience, you have to find mental space to have like a long runway, so to speak, of of knowing that you like that 8 hour day just sounds wonderful to me. Like, oh, I can just work for 8 hours on this one thing. And I'm in a space right now where, you know, we talked about summer and distractions of summer. This week, I'm gearing up to give a talk at the Tri-Swift conference in New York, which is starting on, you know, it's this Thursday and Friday. And I'm in one of those weeks where even though I'm more or less prepared for that show, my mind is occupied with it. And it's like, should I be doing another rehearsal of the talk? Should, you know, I actually have a little bit of sample code I want to write to go with that. I don't have that 8 hour runway. So, I am looking forward myself to next week. My kids will be back in school. I've also let this is another way that the indie lifestyle can slide a little bit. With my kids not having to be at school at a specific hour in the morning and, you know, being able to kind of get up and occupy themselves, I've been snoozing a little bit. So it's like I'm shaving an hour off of my day in the morning.
Yeah.
And, you know, my boss is not happy. my theoretical boss. But I am kind of looking forward to the for all the like hassle of having kids and them going to school and all this stuff, it's kind of nice that they keep you on a schedule, especially for indie developers who we don't have any natural schedule built in usually. So like for me, it's like, oh, I got to get my kid to school at 8. That means I start my workday at 8:30, you know? And that's not guaranteed without that, the help of that kind of hard time constraint.
Yeah, we certainly started sleeping in a bunch over the summer. And I was kind of worried, like a couple of days before school started, like everybody's still sleeping till like noon. Some, you know, maybe not sleeping, but at least, you know, like lounging around and very, very late breakfasts. And I realized that I probably should have taken better advantage of that. Like I probably should have been getting up at 6 in the morning when everyone else was sleeping till 10 and, you know, working kind of while the house was quiet. And I did that a couple of times by accident, but yeah, now it's like, there's that forced time. Everybody has to get out the door and, it's good. I usually get up a little before the kids, kind of catch up on work and email and stuff just for half an hour. And then there's the whole chaos of everybody getting ready and getting out the door. But it's nice to have that schedule a little bit where, yeah, you know, at least by, like you said, 8:30 or whatever time it is, You're going to sit down and you're going to start working.
Yep. So I'm excited about this conference, but I, to be honest, coming back to like, you know, I talked about my like list of tasks and my hours it's going to take to do it. I'm ashamed to say, I don't think I've looked at that list since last week when we talked about it on the show. That's just like how much other stuff is going on, I guess. And it's not like I'm being lazy or anything. It's so easy to get sidetracked away from the same sort of main track of things. I think next week I will celebrate. This is what it's like, folks, being an indie software developer. You look forward to celebrating a straight 8 hour workday. It's going to be a thing of beauty, Manson. Yeah.
And then after a couple of weeks of 8 hours, you're going to be like, oh my gosh, I need to go on vacation again. I need to take some time off.
It will be time. I mean, it will be a couple of weeks. You got to have a vacation every couple of weeks, right?
Hey, it's pretty good. Pretty good. All right. Well, it's good talking to you this week. It's good to catch up on some Apple news, see what everybody's schedule is like. Good luck with your talk. Hope everything goes well with that.
Thank you.
And thanks everyone for listening to the show. Of course, we'd love to hear feedback. We don't do follow-up on the show very much with feedback, but we always reply to people and enjoy having the feedback. And usually some of those go into notes that we can follow up on in a later episode. So at Corent on Twitter, feedback@corent.org over email. And we've got the Slack channels, chat.corent.org. Easy to join. You can discuss with fellow listeners and other people. Not everyone's a listener to the shows. Other developers in there talking about code or projects or business. So check that out.
Why did we let them in?
Well, first of all, we thought everybody was a listener, but it turns out I know a few people have joined and like, oh yeah, I don't subscribe to the podcast, but you know, they're all part of the community and they're all, most of their listeners and you know, they're all iOS developers or Mac developers.
And just like the show's audience, it's not all developers, it's designers, it's product managers, and it's kind of a great mix of people who are just thoughtful about software as we try to be here on the show. And of course, I don't think we mentioned it this time, Manton, but we're going to probably make a habit of mentioning the job board, jobs.corent.org. Great place to look for a job or to put up a listing for a job if you're looking to find some of the best iOS and Mac developers in the world who happen, in my experience, to listen to this show.
Yep, check it out. Thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you next week.